Greetings and welcome to the 11th episode of the NASCAR and NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. Our guest this week is Jason Wygant, who is a jack of many trades. Jason is the editor of Racer X Online magazine, which covers Supercross and Motocross extensively. He also is the host of Motocross events on the NBC Sports Network. And Jason also has done some reporting for NASCAR America. I'm sure you've seen him on the program interviewing drivers and crew chiefs. He also likely will do some spot duty as a pit reporter on NASCAR races on NBC Sports later this year. But the primary focus of today's episode, this discussion, is about Supercross and Motocross in relation to NASCAR. There's been a lot of crossover between these racing series in the last couple of months, and there actually could be a lot of similarities in the future as well. Jason is at the focal point of much of that because he's been immersed in motorbike racing for years. He brings a lot of insight to a sport that has a surprising number of intricacies. Much like NASCAR and other racing series, on the surface, Supercross might seem simple, but when you peel back the layers in a deeper analysis, it reveals there's a lot more to be found there. I always enjoyed covering Supercross in my years at USA Today Sports because of the riders' personalities and all the intriguing storylines that you can find. We get into primary discussions on two of those storylines in this episode. First is the recent Supercross event at the Georgia Dome that happened on the same weekend that NASCAR was at Atlanta Motor Speedway. So it drew many drivers and NASCAR industry types to downtown Atlanta to see motorbike racing on the dirt. So we got into what Supercross and NASCAR personalities sort of discovered about each other, what they think about each other, and the mostly positive reception that there seems to be on both sides of the aisle there. We also get into discussing, will there be a Chase-style championship in the Supercross series next year? Jason says it's being considered, so we're definitely going to delve into that, given that NASCAR, of course, has been down that path already. And with rider Ryan Dungey on the cusp of clinching the Supercross title with three races left in the season, it's certainly topical right now in Supercross as well. As always, we appreciate you listening and your support. Please leave a rating or review on iTunes if you like what you hear, or spread the word socially. We certainly were grateful for a retweet of our Dale Jarrett podcast last week from Dale Earnhardt Jr. Special thanks to NBC Sports producer Tess Quinlan for doing the tweet promo that drew that retweet from Dale Jr. Tess has been involved with promoting and producing this podcast, and we are certainly grateful to have her. She's done some great work for us. Also, stay tuned next week when we'll have Trevor Bayne scheduled as our guest. But now, without further ado, here's Jason Wygant. Jason, thanks for being here. I know we've talked about this for quite a while. Yeah. I know you're a podcast aficionado, and certainly appreciate you listening to this podcast.
Well, I've been waiting for someone to do a podcast like this for about 3 years now, so I'm glad you did it. And now that I'm on it, it's almost like a weirdo, like, two-way mirror. Like, I just want this podcast to exist so I can listen to it. Now I'm going to be listening to myself. This is very strange.
Yeah. All right, so we're mainly going to talk about Supercross and NASCAR and similarities, differences, and you certainly have a window into that, given that you primarily do most of your work with the bikes, but you've also done some work over the past couple of years. NASCAR America, we've seen you do interviews and helping out in NBCSN. I guess maybe we could just start there. Give us how you cover both. You dip your toe a little bit in NASCAR, but you're primarily on the motorbike side.
Yeah, I actually started out, it's a motocross guy growing up and all those things, and that's the industry I wanted to work in. Actually, when I got out of college, I got a PR role with a series. And then much like what happens to you, you're the PR person or the journalist, you have a lot of information, right? So the announcers start interviewing you. And I guess I had a knack for it, so they started interviewing me more and more. And then eventually they just give you the microphone. And the next thing I know, I was an announcer. And the series I were covering were so small-time, they didn't have announcers that knew anything about them. So they'd put them on TV, and they're like, well, you could be the TV guy too. So eventually I was the announcer, the PR guy, and the TV person for these smaller series. And then I just kept kind of working my way up. So eventually I became the play-by-play for Pro Motocross, which is on NBC in the summertime. So for folks that don't know, the sport is half the year is Supercross, half the year is Motocross. Right? It's basically the same amount of races as NASCAR, but we split it in half. Supercross is on Fox, Motocross is on NBC. So I become the NBC Motocross guy, about 12 years into my career. Well, I moved down to this area to see if there were other motorsports broadcasting opportunities. This is Charlotte, right? This is where these things are happening. And then NBC signs a NASCAR deal. You know, they didn't really have a huge crew yet. I think you were at USA Today still at the time, kind of helping out. I was the motocross guy, so I was just helping out. So because of that, I did get that window into NASCAR. I consider myself, I guess, the backup to the backup. When you and Marty Snyder and Mike Massaro and Dave Burns and Kelly Stavis and everybody's busy, they call me and tell me to go to a shop and do some interviews.
Well, you certainly do a fine job when you are called out of the bullpen to do that. So we appreciate it and look forward to seeing you hopefully even on more so in the 2016 season. Are you going to be doing any NASCAR races?
Yeah, that's the hope. I know that they get in a little bind when we have the off-site Xfinity races. You know, there's somewhere there are literally two different tracks on the same weekend. So maybe I'll do some pit reporting there and things like that.
Terrific. Yep. And as you mentioned, you live in the Charlotte area, actually mm-hmm. fairly close, I would think, to Joe Gibbs Racing, right?
Yeah, and that was one of the hooks. I still work, I guess I should say, full-time for RacerX Magazine and RacerXOnline.com, which is, I guess, the biggest magazine and website in Supercross and Motocross. But that's based out of West Virginia. Why? Because the family that owns it, that's where they're from. The Coombs are very much the Frances of the motocross game. That's where they started. That's where they want to live. So I lived there for 11 years, and then I moved here. So that was a little hook that I had. Well, if I go down there, there, you know, there's a motocross team right down the road,
right?
Because Gibbs happens to have a motocross team.
Right.
I was really only moving here for more broadcast opportunities, but that helped grease the skids a little bit. Yeah.
Well, it worked out, I think, for mm-hmm. you in all ways. And as you mentioned, Joe Gibbs Racing does have a supercross team mm-hmm. and motocross team. And there's been, I think, more and more crossover in that regard over the last 5, 6, 7 years as they've become more of an established team. And I think I want to start by talking about what we saw at Atlanta this year, because for the second straight year that Atlanta fell on the NASCAR
yeah,
weekend?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the second straight year where NASCAR was in Atlanta for its Sprint Cup weekend, second race of the year, and Supercross happened to be there for its big event that Saturday night at the Georgia Dome. So you always have that natural crossover where those of us who follow drivers on Twitter or whatnot, social media, we see them posting about all sorts of series, Formula One, sports cars, but especially, sure. I think, Supercross, especially early in the year.
Yeah, oddly. And I think that's just almost the luck of the Saturday night. They know it's going to be on, and that's the one time of the weekend they're just in the motorhome, right?
Right.
It's almost fallen into this perfect window for all the drivers to watch.
Right, right,
yeah.
Right. So this is an opportunity, obviously, not just for drivers to go to the Supercross event. We saw a lot of that in 2015. I can vividly remember them interviewing Jeff Gordon, Danica Patrick, and
yep.
a suite at the Georgia Dome. Well, this year they actually got to participate.
Yes.
I use that word with air quotes and very lightly, having witnessed this exhibition
right.
In person, as it was very much an exhibition. You had Clint Bowyer, Ricky Stenhouse Jr., Greg Biffle. Who am I forgetting? There was a fourth.
Ty Dillon. Yeah.
On bikes. All of them with some modicum of experience on bikes
yeah.
participating in this.
That's still a tough sell. I don't
yeah.
know how they convinced. The funny thing about this is, and we'll get into this, we talked to some of the changes that are potentially coming to Supercross. That event happened because Clint Bowyer's brother.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Clint and his brother Andy were motocrossers growing up. Andy was friends at my boss, Davey Coombs. We eventually gave him a job. He worked for us. He lived in my house for like 3 years. We were roommates. He now works for the Supercross people. He moved from the magazine side to the promotion side. So he obviously had this great connection. His brother is a Sprint Cup driver. They had the race that weekend, and he knew enough drivers and knew enough marketing people to make these phone calls and kind of ram this thing through the system. You wrote the story. You know what I'm talking about. So that was just an amazing coincidence that the two races were the same weekend.
Right.
And one of the driver's brothers happens to work for the Supercross promoter
yeah.
who had just enough clout to do something. I mean, would you have ever imagined the day before a race
right.
that these drivers could do this?
Right. No, never uh-huh. would be the answer. And that Andy pulled it together, I think, in like 5 or 6 weeks or something.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
somewhat
I think
astounding.
He's new there and he knew, like, if I could get this coup, this would seal my new job for life.
Right.
So I think he went all out on it. And you had, by the way, in your story, one of the greatest observations of a person ever. This shows your journalistic instincts. As the color rushed back into his face, which, if you know Andy and maybe Clint also, that happens a lot. There's a lot of on-off switch with the emotions. So that had to be a crazy night for him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we definitely saw a lot during the course of that evening, Jason. And what I was most struck by was normally NASCAR and other racing series, they don't always play nice, and especially the fan bases don't always play nice.
Yeah.
We saw this, unfortunately, a few weeks ago with the Phoenix IndyCar race, where Brad Keselowski and Jimmy Johnson had the temerity to suggest on Twitter that perhaps that race wasn't quite up to snuff in terms of passing, which IndyCar drivers later admitted openly and candidly it wasn't. They all suggested, like, hey, maybe they might want to consider aero changes like we've done in NASCAR. Downforce reduction might lead to more passing. Created this just tidal wave of, like, negativity on Twitter, which, again, unfortunately, is frequently the norm in racing, where series don't get along. I don't know if it's bikes versus cars or what the deal is, but in NASCAR and Supercross, I don't find that at all. And I especially saw it on display that night in Atlanta. So I want to get you just to kind of give your perspective on one, how NASCAR drivers were received both by the fan base and the Supercross paddock, and two, maybe why you think that might be.
I think they lucked out that they managed to get them to do this race that you and I would have never thought would have happened in a million years. They actually got them on bikes. And then, to make things even better, Clint Bowyer went so all out, he was willing to crash to win this thing, which I heard one person, a guy that I do the podcast with on the Racer X side, say, well, that's embarrassing for NASCAR. He crashed on a motorcycle. He's the only person, I think, that thought that. I think everyone else in the stands had full respect of, wow,
right,
these guys really are competitors. There's nothing on the line, and he was willing to crash. How could you not respect that?
Right.
I think that helped. I will say that it's with trepidation that the motocross people look at NASCAR. I don't know. It might even just be, in the case of the IndyCar example you gave, and in the case I'm going to give with some of the Supercross fans not always liking NASCAR,
mm-hmm.
is it partially like the Walmart factor of, or the McDonald's factor? You're number one, so
I
just like picking on
you. Yeah, I think there's inherent jealousy, resentment, however you want to characterize
yes.
it. Yeah.
So what I've seen is a surprising level of respect from the NASCAR side to Supercross, considering NASCAR is phenomenally bigger. Those drivers are bigger stars. They make more money. They could have egos where they would not allow any Supercross rider to even be in their orbit if they wanted. They are the bigger stars. The NASCAR drivers have been tremendously open to respecting the Supercross side, even though it's relatively minor leagues compared to what they're doing. I think the Supercross riders love getting that kind of respect. The Supercross industry loves getting that kind of respect. But on the fan side, it's still, I think it was okay until these comparisons started to get made. And there's this rumor that a chase format, which we'll get to here, is coming to Supercross. And that's making the fans very nervous. And now they're taking all these NASCAR comparisons and they're getting very worried. They don't like hearing the similarities or the respect or the communication between the drivers from both sides, because they're afraid that this is going to turn motocross into NASCAR, which they are very worried about.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And we will get to this in a minute, but I know we've talked about this in the past. It cracks me up that Supercross fans would have the same initial impression reaction to a playoff that I think NASCAR fans really had.
Well, that's my question. Okay, so in 2003, when it was coming, what was the thought?
It was very much trepidation and
really?
Fear and loathing within the NASCAR fan base. And
wow.
I think there's still a section of the fan base that certainly is resistant to it, but I think on balance it's become accepted. It's NASCAR is a Southern sport with Southern roots, and I think that when you change things, this is a fan base that is traditionally resistant to change, and they have to see how it works before they can. And I would think I can't compare it really to the bike fandom, but I would think that there's probably some element there, knowing it's a niche sport, knowing mm-hmm. that, again, we'll get to this, but knowing that they like things the way they are,
yeah.
When things change, it's probably difficult to wrap their head around. But we'll get to that. I want to talk first about, you mentioned it, everybody talked about Clint Bowyer.
Yeah.
Certainly, that was like the moment that he wipes out while winning this drag race on bikes against his three fellow Sprint Cup drivers. But that wasn't the only reason it was talked about the next day.
Yeah.
At Atlanta Motor Speedway, and in the week after, I think there was a lot of chatter. I heard it on another podcast, on Door Bumper Clear, the JR Motorsports, Junior Motorsports podcast that TJ Majors and Brett Griffin do. They were talking about seeing that the demographics
yeah.
at that Atlanta event and comparing it to NASCAR. What do you think, I mean, what did you hear maybe from the NASCAR industry about what they saw or what they see when they go to an event like Atlanta?
Yeah, I think anyone on the Supercross side, such as myself, who's lived in it, you're just pre-programmed that you know the sport you're in is the stepchild. It's the minor leagues. NASCAR is monumentally larger, and it still is. You can fudge some numbers, and I think you could argue that there probably was a larger crowd at the Georgia Dome for Supercross than there might
have been.
Yeah. Right, and you can get a lot of mileage out of that if you want to twist it that way.
Right.
But let's look at almost any other metric, and NASCAR is massively bigger.
Starting with sponsorship dollars.
Starting with sponsorship dollars or TV ratings, or that's the biggest Supercross, and that's one of the weakest crowds, unfortunately, right now. I think on the, you know, I didn't hear anyone comparing the 101,000 Daytona 500 spectators to any Supercross.
Right.
So I think that everyone is used to just we're minor leagues. And then all of a sudden, when there was all this positive energy, again, the NASCAR people didn't have to say that. Mm-hmm. They could easily walk softly and carry the big stick. But for some reason, they were throwing a lot of love at Supercross. And I think it took people by surprise. Well, wait a minute. Maybe we have something here. And I suppose what they have, again, I feel like nothing more than sheer accident, is this portal into this young demographic that NASCAR is so desperate to get. And I saw you in the, and Dustin Long in the pits there, and you were kind of marveling at how young the fans in the pits in Atlanta looked compared to a NASCAR crowd. And I guess that's what everyone's interested in now.
Right, right. So why do you think they have such a younger demographic? Why is that?
Well, I think compared to NASCAR, it's both, in some ways, NASCAR's failure to get into that group. So that doesn't help in the first place. NASCAR hasn't capitalized on that. The natural inclination for dirt bikes, I guess, to draw kids or 20-year-olds is pretty easy. But what has also helped big time is, on the NASCAR side, there's all this talk about the shortened attention spans, right? You can't go 15 minutes on XM radio without them talking about, should we shorten the races? Or should we have, heat races?
Right.
Like we just did, right?
Right.
So Supercross, by virtue of just never changing anything ever, they've had the same format since they started in 1974, which is to have a couple heat races and a very short main event, which will take less than 20 minutes. Suddenly, that has become the perfect model. The entire race, anything you need to know from that race, you could watch on YouTube in about 17 minutes.
Right.
So digestible. And what has also helped, okay, now we're on social media. Here's a huge difference I've noticed in the two sports right here. NASCAR still seems to be very much into Twitter. Twitter is a big part of NASCAR, correct? The Supercross side has left Twitter in the dust about 2 years ago.
No kidding.
It is all Instagram.
Huh.
And I've been trying to figure out why. Why is Twitter done? The riders go to Instagram. They don't go to Twitter any longer to air their grievances. Because dirt bikes, you can have a 15-second video clip and show something amazing. You can do a whip over a jump or go through a turn. You can do something great in a 15-second video clip on Instagram. And there really aren't many sports that fit that 15-second, I can do something that'll blow your mind model like dirt bikes.
Right.
They didn't change anything. They didn't come up with any rules to draw a younger demo. They just fell into it. And now that they've fallen into it, I guess on the NASCAR side, you have to say, maybe we could take something that they have. Lo and behold, here we are with heat races.
Yeah.
So interesting how that's turning out.
That is interesting. Well, I guess, and obviously, you could put a 15-second video on Twitter, but Instagram being probably more of the more basic visual platform. I mean, Twitter is 140 characters. You can post stuff on Instagram, but the primary thing you see is something visual. And I guess that would be the appeal of that.
But I also think it ties into, if you have a younger demographic already,
yes,
the people that are looking for things to watch on Instagram are probably more interested in that type of action than the type of action they would see. I mean, what is the most spectacular thing you could show? I guess a pass at Bristol, that last lap was pretty good.
Right.
You know, at Kurt Busch and Junior and Chase Elliott, that was pretty exciting.
Right.
You give a post-race burnout. So there's a few things, but dirt bikes just lend themselves to those 15-second bursts.
Right.
So if you're on Instagram already, you're 18 years old, Instagram is, your Twitter's already for your grandparents, and I guess Facebook's for your great-grandparents at this point. You're looking for something cool to see. The dirt bikes are cool.
Yeah.
So they're just working out that way.
Yeah. And going to that younger demographic, and I think this is what a lot of the NASCAR industry was struck by, walking around the pits. Some real basic similarities between NASCAR and the bikes and drag racing. I mean, it's not as true in NASCAR, but NASCAR, obviously, if you have a pit pass, you have a hot pass, you can get down the garage and be close to the action.
Yeah.
At drag racing, Supercross, to me, it's even more so. I mean, in my mind, that like, it's not just that you can be close to the action, but you can be standing behind the ropes and watching a rider or a driver like walk by their vehicles. You don't really see that quite as much in the same way in NASCAR. So I don't know if that's part of the appeal. But again, like this younger demographic that Supercross has, I think, on one hand, some NASCAR teams and sponsors would probably salivate for, because these are young families. These are couples in their early 20s pushing strollers with little kids who are going to have discretionary income to spend for decades to come. And if you're a company looking to sponsor an event, that's what would draw you in. But what about NASCAR do you think works better? Again, not asking you to compare them, but obviously there's a reason sponsors have success with activation and with being in NASCAR.
Yes.
Is there a point like where Supercross isn't maybe fully maximizing those opportunities?
Absolutely. Don't worry, I'm not on here as the full-time Racer X motocross guy to say how awesome Supercross is. Keep in mind that most of the advantages I'm saying Supercross has, and they're small advantages, like I said, are mostly on accident.
Right.
I can't even say that people are brilliantly coming up with these schemes. Dirt bikes and short attention spans have just morphed over 40 years in like a perfect storm.
Right.
But on the other end, absolutely. What I think NASCAR has done very well, I get this all the time from people who don't get NASCAR, don't understand why it's popular. They're always trying to. They're like, man, these it's race cars, but they're the least sophisticated race car. Like, look at the technology of F1. What I've noticed now from following NASCAR so closely for the last couple of years, doing this work with NASCAR America. I feel like NASCAR has done the best job of any motorsport of being the least motorsports-like of motorsports. Hear me out on this.
Right.
They've done an excellent job of making it a battle of people and personalities. We do know now that there are engineers and there are laptops and there are scientists that are making things better or different on the racetrack. But you can still boil a lot of NASCAR racing down to the personality of the man behind the wheel or the woman and the personality of the crew chief and the pep talk of the crew chief or the strategy call of the crew chief. I think that that turns people off to a lot of other racing. I mean, Formula One has become basically a science experiment every weekend, which some people clearly appreciate. It's very popular around the world. But at the same time, it's easy to talk about NASCAR as this guy wanted it more. This crew chief made a great strategy call. This is a personality thing, just like football is, just like the NBA is. Who has the heart? Who refused to lose? And all these things. And I think NASCAR has done an excellent job of keeping the car and the science of it out of the way,
mm-hmm.
not making it too complicated. I even feel like with the level we are, we could probably dig even. We know that the things that are making a difference in a race, it's probably not all hero work. Like, we want to believe, for example, that Gibbs went on a great run last year, for example. You can praise Joe Gibbs. You can praise their drivers. You can praise their crew chiefs. Probably behind the scenes, there was some science and technical work that was brilliant. That's not a sexy story.
Right.
You didn't go hunting for it. We just novel at the talent that we always knew that Kyle Busch had. That's what you can do. You can marvel at the talent that Kobe Bryant has. You can marvel at the talent that Tom Brady has. I think NASCAR's done an excellent job of being the most like the other popular sports of all motorsports. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, yeah, that does. Mm-hmm. That's perhaps one of the better dissections I've heard of why I thought about this long and hard.
Well, yes.
And again, you have a different viewpoint of it, and
that's where it comes from. And I have so many people questioning how could NASCAR be more popular. We have riders doing jumps,
right?
The other thing, by the way, is that it's so funny to hear NASCAR fans say that, you know, the mile and a half tracks have been somewhat boring, the racing used to be better. There's still no comparison. NASCAR has the best parity and best unpredictable racing of any major motorsport. It's not even close.
Right.
I guess your local short track or dirt track might be even more competitive. But for the most part, Supercross and F1 and even drag racing, IndyCar, they don't have this kind of parity and passing that NASCAR does.
Right.
That helps.
Right. That helps a lot. And, of course, some of it is, I would say, manufactured, but certainly some the championship race, and again, we're going to get to this in a minute after one more point, but that's certainly by design. NASCAR ensures parity, and that's something Supercross is looking at. One more thing I want to ask you about the Supercross experience, the pits. Again, that access that fans have and seeing riders, and I know riders, for the most part, when I've interviewed them, when I used to work at USA Today Sports, I found them very accessible, very accommodating. I've seen them sign a lot of autographs. I still see NASCAR drivers do that, but the demands on their time and myriad other reasons, I don't see them maybe being quite as active sometimes as I see riders. Do riders, do you think they understand that there's more of an obligation for them to be seen in the pits or to make sure that, like, if you're a fan coming to a race, like, you get an experience unlike any other?
I think a lot of it is just you could probably look at NASCAR had this explosion, say, in the 1990s. So maybe before that, when it was scaled back quite a bit, I would be very curious to see how similar the pit area or the motorhome lot was at NASCAR then. I think a lot of it is just born out of the overall scale of how big the Supercross pits are, how popular, how many people are pulling at them. I think it's just, I think NASCAR does as well as they can
right.
for as many obligations and as many people are trying to get a hold of these drivers. They give as much access as they possibly could. But when you multiply the audience times five at the track, times millions on TV, I think it's just hard to give that. I think the riders could potentially get more insulated and isolated if the sport grows. I think a lot of the access is just based on the size of the sport. Yeah. I would love to give credit and say that this is, there's a lot of PR things that I think that the Supercross side could learn from NASCAR.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of things they're doing right, I think, are just an accident.
Okay. Well, moving away from the happy accidents mm-hmm. that have benefited them in some ways and moving toward the designs for a different future and the great boogeyman that you mentioned about bringing in the NASCAR chase.
Yes.
tell us more about that. And is it imminent? Do you sense it's going to be something that's in place for 2017 at this point?
At one point, I believed it was imminent, but they had a meeting last Friday before their race in Indianapolis. And it was the first time that they had really, by the way, Supercross is run by the Feld family, which, make up your own jokes here, they run Ringling Brothers Circus. They also bought Supercross and Monster Trucks. So whenever things get a little sideways, that's the first thing the fans can always point to. They're circus and monster truck people. They don't understand a sport. You know? And I guarantee you, if this chase things happen, they're going to be that. They will poke at that hole over and over, which is probably not even relevant. But that's the hole they will go to. Anywho, the chase thing, I believe, was going to happen. They did have a meeting with the teams last Friday, before last weekend. And the one out the teams had is that NASCAR has a tremendous purse. The purse money's great. I know it's not enough to fund a team, but NASCAR is doing the promoters are doing their part to give you a lot of money to win these races. Supercross, the economic balance is much more so in the teams. The purse is basically inconsequential to the riders. Ryan Dungey makes his millions from KTM. He makes another million from Red Bull and another million from his gear company. The money he's getting from the promoters doesn't matter much. So the teams have a lot of power. And what they basically, I believe, are said, wait a minute, we have bonuses for championships and race wins. If you change the format so dramatically, that might change the bonus structure that we've already contracted to the rider for next year. Now, I'm not sure that's really a problem,
right,
or if that's what they're doing to try to delay the inevitable and push back a little bit. Because the biggest difference between NASCAR and motocross isn't actually the two and four wheels. It's the power structure of NASCAR rules all. They made that decision. That's why they call it the modern era. We mm-hmm. are not going to be a factory controlled by Ford, GM, Chevy any longer. We're going to turn it into an outside sponsorship so we can have more control. The teams still have a ton of control in the Supercross side, so it gets very hard to make any changes. Think about this. It's almost amazing to read old NASCAR stories from the 60s to know that rule changes in NASCAR were affecting the production line of the
right.
automobile. Like,
right.
that's unfathomable today,
right?
Right? That was the way it was. Well, Supercross is still absolutely married to that. If you want to make any changes to the rules, it has to go all the way back to a factory in Japan that probably has the prototype 2019 bike already done. How are you going to change such a massive thing? So the result is they never are able to change pretty much anything. And then they're going to drop this level of change, which I still think is going to happen.
Right.
The team's got a little pushback there, but I wouldn't doubt that it's going to happen next year.
What would the framework look like? Would it be a certain number of events that would be in the chase and how many riders would be eligible and points resets?
Yeah, here's the funny thing about it. So as soon as this rumor kind of got out, myself and a couple other journalists kind of heard that it was going to happen. Fans went crazy and they immediately started looking at the NASCAR model and figuring, well, this is what they're going to copy.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly enough, there's the Arena Cross Championship, also run by the same folks at Feld, that started doing this 4 years ago. Nate, it's not called the chase, it's called the race to the championship. Nothing to do with chase
no,
at all.
No, no,
race
at all.
To the championship. So they've already been doing it in their series that they call the feeder series.
Right.
But as it often happens, I'm sure you see it, NASCAR can make changes at the truck series or the Xfinity series or the K&N series, but people are only looking at the top. They're not looking at the obvious.
Sure.
Right. So all the fans are looking at the NASCAR model to try to see what it will be. Not noticing that, look below you.
They're already doing it.
Arena Cross has already been doing it 4 years. And what they basically did is, the Supercross is 17 rounds. I'm sure it'll be, say, 12 regular season races,
mm-hmm.
and then reset the points for the last five. I think that fans are getting even more up in arms, because if you look at the current NASCAR chase, it's even more elaborate with the elimination structure. I don't believe they're going to do anything like that.
How many riders do you think would be?
Well, I bet you they'll do 10 because that's a nice even number.
Yeah.
But because the parity in NASCAR is so great, I mean, even with 16, you can argue that almost all 16 have a fairly good shot. Maybe 12 of the 16 that get in, you can make a case that any one of them could win the title. If you let 10 in Supercross, you're still probably looking at three
right.
that are going to win that title.
Right.
Yeah. The 10th place, no one in Supercross could ever go from 10th to 1st in one weekend. You're never going to make that kind of jump. In NASCAR, that's week to week, that's commonplace.
That's doable.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you brought up that point about how teams argued that, hey, we've got contracts, we've got sponsors, we've got bonuses.
Yeah.
You asked earlier about parallels to 2003.
Yes.
This has triggered a parallel to 2003.
Oh, excellent.
I just remembered.
Okay.
When NASCAR was rolling out really what they were doing, when they were floating the trial balloon that became the Chase,
mm-hmm.
and kind of gave people a very vague vision of this is what we think it's going to be, that was some of the blowback from teams was,
uh-huh.
if you have 26 races that matter and then 10 races that only matter to, at the time, 10 drivers,
yes.
matter being relative, of course, everybody's
right.
still competing. The whole fear and loathing was around, well, sponsors aren't going to pay you for those last 10 races. There's going to be some discount rate. So it's interesting to me that, again, like,
yeah.
the parallels there are very, very similar between what you heard then and what you're
and
hearing now.
And you have
now.
To wonder, I mean, it must have been tough back then. I mean, I remember when NASCAR announced it, and it had never been done
right.
in any sort. And it just, you could not wrap your head around this
right.
concept. And I think a lot of the doomsday scenarios, or pretty much all of the doomsday scenarios, did not come true.
No,
I know the first theory is some teammate's going to take someone out just to help their.
No,
hasn't really happened.
Hasn't. I mean, the closest teammate controversy we've had to that would be what happened last year with Kenseth taking out Logano, but
yeah,
that wasn't really
that was really
team
between
related.
Them.
That was a this
right.
pure rivalry. Yeah.
Yes, that was between them. Yeah. So a lot of the doomsday scenarios did not happen, but I understand why people before they'd ever seen it would be scared. But at this point, anyone who's doing a playoff type format, there's plenty of data that proves most of the things you're worried about
right.
aren't going to happen. What fans are most up in arms about is, obviously, it's making the success at the beginning of the season, which you've worked very hard to earn, irrelevant. But I challenge anyone, just like when NASCAR changed the format in 2014, when they changed the elimination format. And I know that seemed, in many people's minds, even crazier and hokier and less fair than ever.
Right.
But I challenge you to have not been on the edge of your seat
right.
for some of those rounds.
It was
phenomenal.
It was an unqualified success that first year. And even
right.
those who took issue with some parts of it, and I would count myself
mm-hmm.
in that group, is I very much found it to be too much of a game of chance when you're resetting the points three times.
Yes.
But the outcome the first 2 years, and especially that first year, was phenomenal. I mean, it was undeniable that the Homestead Miami finale in 2014 was one of the best moments that the Chase has ever had. And they finally got to that point after tweaking it four times. And it's not to say there weren't past chases that weren't that scintillating, that the first year of the Chase was, certainly. 2007 was a great battle between Jimmy Johnson and Jeff Gordon, but there were some where Johnson was still wrapping it up a race early.
Yeah, some of those moments in 2014, Keselowski winning at Talladega or,
right.
or running into Gordon in Texas, these are just, they're indelible now. They're weaved into NASCAR. You'll never forget these
right.
moments. So what I'm saying to the Supercross fans that are very worried, and it seems like 99% of them are, the last three
just a small segment
yeah,
of your fan base.
I mean, they are up in arms. The last three Supercross races have been really exciting. It's been Ryan Dungey and Ken Roczen. I mean, Ken Roczen all over Dungey for all 20 laps trying to make a pass. That's been pretty exciting to watch. Imagine if those three races came after a points reset.
Right.
As exciting as they are right now, Dungey is sitting on practically a two-race lead in points. So as exciting as it is to watch, it's not a game changer if Roczen makes the pass. But man, if they had the points reset before that and they went at it for 20 laps and now they were tied and there's only three races to go, people would have been
right.
going insane. So what I just keep saying to every fan who's not for this, I said, okay, but when we get to round 12 next year and they're tied, you better not get excited. I
right.
want to see you not be excited about this. Good
right.
luck. Yeah.
Right. So there's three events left in the year, just to put a bow on this season.
Yeah.
Foxborough, New Jersey.
Yeah,
New
York, it's Giant Stadium right outside
okay.
of New York. Yeah,
and Las Vegas. And
yep.
and your feeling, Jason, is that Dungey probably locks it up with
yeah.
two to go.
The poor promoters felt they could not have been given a greater gift to prove why this Chase format would be beneficial. The exact way the season has gone, Ryan Dungey is so consistent. He's dominated. he's probably going to wrap up the title this weekend. Two races to go, he'll have the title wrapped up. And lately, Ken Roczen has been surging and matching him, but he wasn't quite on his game at the beginning of the year. He fell hopelessly behind in points. So they have the model they can put right in front of you and say, the fact that Dungy is wrapping up the title two races early is all the proof we need. And they've actually done the data, and I believe in the last 25 years, only 8 out of 25 years has the title gone to the finale. So you would think that's all the info you need to educate the fans on why this would be good. But whereas NASCAR is, like I said, the most stick-and-ball sport-like of motorsports, at least in my mind, so maybe it makes it a little more digestible to say, hey, we know how the Super Bowl works. It doesn't matter how well the Panthers played all year. If they have a dud when it counts, the Panthers had the best overall record, didn't they? It doesn't get you the title. On the Supercross side, they've not changed any rules at all in about 30 years, and the fans are used to it being the most pure of sports. There are never changes made to tighten the racing. There are never technical, even F1 tries, maybe it doesn't work. IndyCar has changed the engineering of their cars multi times over in the last 10 years. They never change anything in Supercross. So this is the worst audience to try to put this on, even with this data staring them right in the face. Dungy's going to wrap the title up two races early, and they say, so be it, may the best man win.
And I can respect, Jason, like why fans would struggle with that. Like you said, if they're conditioned and accustomed to, much like NASCAR fans were for five decades being told, for five decades NASCAR fans were told, like with an just iron fist shoved down their throats, consistency is the king of everything.
Yes, and to their demerit sometimes, right? Matt Kenseth wins a title and they're mad that he didn't win a race or something
like
that.
Right, which was terrible. And like NASCAR, to its credit, realized, I think they thread the needle fairly well, as well as probably they could, given all that history, of saying, look, we still want consistency to be important, but we want to reemphasize that, like, winning matters. Yes. So we don't want to hear this points day crap anymore, to be blunt about it. And it took, I think it took a while for fans to understand that, to sort of just understand, as you just said, that you have to look at it. And again, this is something NASCAR fans for years were told, that stick and ball has it wrong. That's not the pathway, that's not the model. You have to look at through that prism, though, that in this case, it's right. It's okay to say, hey, if you had a really great regular season but stumble when it matters most, that regular season isn't going to matter anymore. That's where racing fans, I think, that are conditioned to believe that championships should be predicated on a season-long performance, because that's how they were taught to believe it was done.
Yes.
That's where I understand that they're going to struggle with initially. But I think if they see... if they have the drama that NASCAR has had in 2014, they're going to see the benefits.
I think there just has to be willing suspension of disbelief. You cannot win the argument and say there's any format that's more fair than saying every race counts the exact same amount. It will never be more fair than that. You cannot make that argument. Now, I think NASCAR has maybe tried by saying, well, look at the playoffs and other sports, see it's very similar. To me, even that is a bit of a tough argument to make, because I always say in football, the worst thing you could have happen in a game is what? Throw an interception and they run it back for a touchdown. So you gave up 6 points. You can come back. But in a car race, your transmission can blow up and you're in a much bigger hole.
Right.
Now, I know you can win your way back in this format, but it's very hard to just say, go win a NASCAR race.
Yeah.
Much worse things can happen in car racing than in any one particular. Even if your quarterback gets hurt, you still have a backup. The game's not over. So in general, it's a tough argument to ever claim it's going to be remotely as fair as counting every race the same. So I think you just have to have the willing suspension of disbelief to say, listen, this is not the Supreme Court. This is not Congress. This is not curing cancer. Right. It's supposed to be entertaining. Right. We're going to throw a little of the fairness out to get a little more of the entertainment in.
Yeah.
You could probably argue, Kyle Busch wasn't even in the first couple of races last year, right? So you could probably easily claim that Kevin Harvick overall was the strongest car team driver last year, or maybe it was Logano. He didn't win the title. Maybe it wasn't the fairest way to determine a NASCAR champ. But again, it's not curing cancer. It's not the Supreme Court. Are we trying to just determine the most fair way, or are we just trying to have a good show? And I guess that's the battle you're always having.
Right. And the teams have said, we'll play by the rules we're given. And if the rules make it more entertaining, and also that's what crowns the champion, then we'll adhere to them. That's the deal. Kyle Busch is a legitimate champion.
Right.
You didn't see Joey Logano out there shaking his fist. I won more races than that guy. No. Or I drove in more races than that guy.
Right.
It didn't matter. And ultimately, that's all that counts. One more. I want to talk about one more thing on this change versus not change, because you brought up something really interesting, Jason, about how so much of the bikes are still production-based, which is what NASCAR has tried to get back to with Gen 6. They want that relevance, and I don't know if they'll ever get to that degree. So maybe is that another benefit of staying in your old ways and staying set in those ways, do you think that's good that they maintain that connection that maybe other racing series don't have?
Well, that's at the very least, would not want to know what the world would be like without it. I cannot give the France family enough credit for having the guts to say, listen, we've tried, you know, we went from a very small sport. Money got pumped in the 50s and 60s because we were lucky that Ford and Chrysler decided to pay our drivers. That's great. And they actually at one point said, you know what, that is great, but we can be greater, and we're going to take the chance. And it was kind of scorched earth for a little while, right, in the late 60s.
Yeah, the factories left for several years.
The factories left, and a lot of people lost a lot of money. A lot of drivers were essentially out of work. With this leap of faith of, if we get Winston, and how lucky were they that cable TV came around within about 10 years of that, and the sport exploded to much greater heights than it would have had if they were beholden to the manufacturers. I mean, these were the days where guys would lap the entire field.
Right.
Or at the beginning of the year, Plymouth comes out with the Superbird. You pretty much know who's going to win the races all year. They had to get away from that model. So it made the sport grow. How they had the courage to literally tell the manufacturers who are pumping money into their series, you're going to have to pound sand. Right. We're going to do it on our own. It'll be better in the long run. On the motocross side, supercross side, since it's not nearly as big, there's no way economically it could hold up unless KTM in this case has decided we're going to front Ryan Dungey a couple million dollars a year. We're going to put the semi in the road. We're going to pay mechanics. We're going to handle the money part. To not have that is unfathomable. I mean, the sport probably wouldn't exist as we know it today. So they have to keep that model. But the funny thing is, the only reason they even have that model in the last rule change they've had of any consequence was 1986. So there you go, 30 years. At that time, there was a brief, as Supercross was invented in the 70s, I'll be quick on this, it didn't exist. They invent it. The tracks are obviously totally different than a motocross race in the woods or in a field. So bikes started changing rapidly for this new sport. It'd be the difference between racing on dirt and racing on pavement. The equipment's going to change rapidly. The factories, like Honda, say, who had unlimited funds, could just invent a better motorcycle, and they were dominating the races. So the sanctioning body basically said, let's make a production rule. That will level the playing field. The privateers who don't have the factory bikes, Honda and everybody else, the frame on your race bike has to be stock. And the engine cases have to be stock. That's the basic rule. The engine cases and the frame have to be stock. This will level the playing field for all the driver, all the riders. That's why they did that. It didn't really level the playing field at all. The best of the best still win. But it created this connection to production bikes. That wasn't even the intent of the rule. But it created this connection to production bikes where now they're pretty much stuck. They can't change anything, because to change a rule at the races, like I said, imagine how difficult with a low downforce package now. That was probably hard. It was hard enough to get that to happen. They had to do experimental races and drivers pounding on the door to make this happen. Imagine if you also had to go to the General Motors engineers for the SS or the Fusion engineers and say this also has to affect the production line. That would have taken 5 years to even change that car. So that connection is good, because if the manufacturers weren't fully invested, if they didn't feel that their product was being proven on the track, they wouldn't pump the millions of dollars into the sport. And I don't think Supercross is big enough to live without that money. NASCAR took the chance to say, if we get Winston's money, if we get on TV, if we bring in outside sponsorship, we don't have to live and die on the factory money. Supercross is not that popular, and I don't know if it'll ever be popular enough to go that direction.
Another example of that, as you said, happenstance, circumstance dictating a lot of this more so than anything else.
That's why I give the France family credit. I mean, how would they have had the vision to guess that would have worked?
Right.
I mean,
it was a gamble.
It was a gamble,
No question. All right, just got a few quick hitters here, and I will just get out of your way when I ask this. We talked about this before you came on. The difference is, you've interviewed riders now, you've interviewed drivers, you've talked to motocross, supercross teams, NASCAR teams. Just the differences between riders versus drivers, teams in both series, how they communicate, how they talk, what sort of information they provide you. How is it different covering each side?
Yeah, one thing I found, the first time they called me to do NASCAR America, this is partway through 2014, I interviewed a couple of crew chiefs, and then they said, can you go to the NASCAR Hall of Fame and interview Jeff Gordon tomorrow? And I'm thinking, You're calling me out of nowhere. You folks have never even met me. I mean, these are the folks from Stanford.
Do you want to do a background check? Do I need to be vetted for this?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Frisk me at the door. And as you know, it's the folks from Connecticut, so they've never even met me face to face. They have no idea if I'm crazy or not. And I'm like, how am I going to pull this off? I mean, I don't have a relationship with Jeff Gordon. I can't ask him hard questions, but I don't want the interview to be a dud. But he has done so many interviews. He's basically a politician at this point, where he's spoken and given talking points to so many people. It could not have gone better, to my benefit, really. Turned out a great interview that I did with Jeff Gordon, really just because he was so well-trained. And there wasn't any questions I could throw at him that were going to knock him back. So it automatically turns into a great interview. That's just the experience of the NASCAR drivers. And what I tell the motocross guys all the time is, just have something interesting to say. You never interview any of the drivers post-race and have them say, yeah, I felt good out there. No, they'll give you something, right? They always give you something.
Right.
So in those sound bites, making that one-minute interview post-race interesting, the Supercross riders really lag. And by the way, a lot of this comes down to the age. I mean, Chase Elliott, it's amazing that he's doing what he's doing for at his age. That's practically the average age of a motocross rider at the top. So you're comparing 30-some and 40-some-year-olds to teenagers and 20-year-olds. So they're not going to be as good as that. But what is interesting during the week, I think I blew your mind when I was telling you this stuff or before this podcast here. I can go down to Ryan Dungey's track and compound on a Wednesday afternoon and hang out and watch him ride all day. And he's not afraid of anything that I would see. I guess that's the smallness of the sport. We make the joke all the time when riders get mad at what someone in the media writes or says. We always say, you're lucky you're not dealing with real media who would not protect you.
The New York media, tabloid media.
Yeah, there you go, tabloid, back of the post.
Right.
No, I don't know. You tell me, how much of the, we're all in this together, this is a small sport, I heard something I probably shouldn't know, I'm not going to put it out there. How much happens on the NASCAR side? Because on the motocross side, we protect each other much more than we expose each other.
Really? That's interesting.
Do you feel that happens?
It's a good question.
Go with it.
I feel like there's, and maybe this is exposing my naivete, but I feel like there's less of that, more so on the NASCAR side, because even though it is somewhat of a cloistered, tight-knit community that travels together, as I'm sure is true for you, it's also a little larger, and I feel like the control on information flow probably a little bit tighter.
Yeah.
On the NASCAR side.
Yeah.
So I don't ever feel like I'm getting 100% of the full story. Mm. And there are some instances in which, yes, there are. Last year, Tony Stewart's retirement, and everybody knew whispers of that months ahead of time.
Okay.
Even Stewart Haas Racing switching to Ford in February. There have been rumblings of that in August. But none since then. And again, I credit the gatekeepers of information and knowledge from not letting some of that get out. So it's probably different. It's probably, this is not like to cast like a minor league look on Supercross and bikes and say, well, you guys don't really know how it works in the big leagues when you have to worry about actually protecting secrets and you're not going to hear stuff that riders are going to say off. I might be overstating it a little bit.
But I think the size of it is, it works in both directions.
Right.
Because the bigger you get, the more sophisticated you get. And the smarter they are about, don't let the media know about this. I don't think on the Supercross side, when two or three decisions get made, at no point do they think, but what if the media finds out about this? Whereas NASCAR is probably, every decision they're making is make sure. Obviously, every step of the way between this Stewart Haas decision, they must have been very careful about who knew, probably used code words for all we know to make sure this didn't get out. I don't think on the motocross side anyone's even thinking about that. But that's also because it's so small that they know folks like myself, if I find out, I'm probably not going to burn them on it.
Yeah.
So it goes both directions. But also NASCAR, you could probably benefit a little more from putting that out there.
Right.
On our end, the sport is so small. I mean, you burn one bridge, you might just be done for life.
True, true. Yeah. I think there is some of that there are more wells to go to if one suddenly runs dry because somebody gets upset with something you said. It's probably different. But I will say, you know, going back to your example about, you know, being able to go to Dungey's house and just see him riding.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I'm thinking, like, okay, what can I compare that to, like, on a Tuesday, Wednesday in NASCAR land? Okay, if I drove up to Huntersville right now and, like, wandered through, like, the engineering department and Joe Gibbs Racing and, like, looked at a laptop or took a took a photo of an engineer's screen for like 5 seconds.
Not happening.
I'd probably like have my smartphone like confiscated,
right.
Destroyed. All privileges of ever being in Joe Gibbs Racing. And again, to their credit, like teams know that they have to protect those trade secrets in a different way. And I feel like that's where the information control is strong.
That's what I learned on the Supercross side. We're always saying, I go back to that, the drivers always give you something.
Right.
And I always said, I'm like, why are they so secretive here at the Supercross races? And NASCAR, you can listen to them on the radio and they tell you what's wrong with their car. This car is tight. This car is loose. On the motocross side, because they're riding production bikes,
right.
Which is a joke because it's a big deal, the frame is stock. It rides totally different. But they're still protecting that image. No rider will ever criticize his equipment publicly, ever. Even so much as to say it's tight or it's loose, the equivalent of that. So I always thought, man, if they could just give more interesting info like NASCAR, the interviews would be better. That's why the NASCAR interviews always have something interesting in them, because on the other side, the riders can't say anything. But as I've gotten closer to NASCAR, I've noticed they're still only giving you 5%, 10%.
Yes.
And they're just working in this same 5-10% window in every interview. So maybe it's not as great as I thought
it was.
Well,
you're right in a sense, though, Jason. I mean, you're seeing the tip of the iceberg competitively.
Yeah.
But I think you're right that, like, Jeff Gordon, he's polished, but it's also that he's had so much experience just being himself in interviews that you do feel like that you're getting – and it's authentic. He gives you something in every interview.
Yep.
It's not going to be like the camber that Hendrick Motorsports ran at Bristol Motor Speedway when he was still driving, but it's going to be like something from his life or something from the team that is a good nugget, as we call them.
And one other thing that helps, one other big difference is Supercross and motocross, it's more rider than bike. It's more of an athletic competition. Put it this way, the best rider on the worst bike will win.
Right.
Where in car racing, any car racing, the worst car is not going to win no matter who is driving it. That's the opposite.
Right.
So what that means is at the end of the day, when you get beat, it's much more on you.
Right.
So it's harder for a rider to say what went wrong because it's much more of a hit on him. It's easier for a driver to come out and say, We had a fourth place car. In Supercross, you're basically saying, I'm the fourth best person here.
Right.
So they can't tell you about their equipment and they don't want to say anything negative about themselves. So you end up with a zero as far as the interviews go because they can't ever admit that they got beat because that's on them. That's
the driver can always put on the equipment.
Yeah,
the driver can always say it's the car.
Yeah, and it's the car. And it's not even a negative thing so far as we know in NASCAR, there's just variances. Hey, if you had just gotten the track bar adjustment a little bit different, that would have made all the difference. It doesn't mean your car is junk.
Right.
But in this case, it would be if a guy in a Kawasaki said, my bike is a fourth place bike, well, that's literally telling someone to go to their dealership and buy a Honda instead,
right.
At least in the mind of the team. So they're never going to go there. So it's a lot different with the kind of stories we get. We basically get almost nothing.
Right. a couple more things. I want to give you a chance to promote, speaking of that NASCAR connection. I know that you did a story. Was it a story this year you did for RaceRex?
Yeah, it's coming
Jimmy
out.
Johnson?
It'll be in our next issue.
Okay.
We're about 3 weeks out on that. This is bizarre. So Jimmy Johnson's people reach out to us at RaceRex, the magazine, and introduce... They're like, there's a driver, Jimmy Johnson.
Hey, six-time champion, you might have heard.
Yeah, he's big into motocross. Now, it's funny, really not because he's such a star that we didn't know that, but that they had no idea that on the Supercross side, we salivate over this Jimmy Johnson success story. If Jimmy Johnson was running around in 20th every weekend for the last 10 years, people would still be pumping their chest saying, oh, one of the motocross guys is doing all right. But he turned out to be the best driver of his generation, and he came from Southern California, the heart of motocross, grew up racing motocross, talks about it. That's something that every motocross fan brags about. But his folks come to us and they're like, hey, I don't know if you know this. And I'm like, do we know it? We're holding a party every day over the fact that Jimmy Johnson has these motocross roots. We use it all the time. Yeah, so they reached out and said he's great friends with Justin Brayton, who's a top rider. And Brayton happens to live in this area, in the Charlotte area. And they mountain bike together all the time. And as you know, Jimmy's a huge trainer.
Right.
So it kind of works for him and his peers to be motocross guys who are on bicycles all the time. So yeah, we went to the Whitewater Center here just outside of Charlotte, hung out with them for the day on mountain bikes, and partially because, again, all the NASCAR guys are just so good in that environment. I mean, you would have thought Jimmy Johnson and I grew up together. Talking to him, it couldn't have been more relaxed. It couldn't have been better. Partially, that's just the NASCAR way.
Right.
But I think also he's so passionate about these things. He's so excited to talk about being on a mountain bike, talk about his Supercross buddy, to get in the Racer X magazine, which he's, I know he reads it, because he just happens to be into motocross.
Right.
I think for him it was really refreshing. So it was an awesome day, and we'll have a video when the magazine comes out too. It's pretty cool.
We'll look forward to that. Jimmy Johnson, of course, is one of the most physically fit drivers in NASCAR. I'd put him in the most recent winner of Bristol, Carl Edwards, in that category of elite training, almost being able to do the marathons, do the triathlons, whatever it is. In that vein, Jason, I know that you have to be, I think people might not realize it who follow NASCAR and not bikes, but being on a bike is so physically punishing. You have to be obviously in decent physical condition to be able to run throughout the course of an event, all the motos and then the main feature race. So in that vein, who do you think, if you had to look at NASCAR drivers, who do you think would make a good rider? That being very subjective, obviously.
Yeah, there's two ways I can answer that. Yeah. For some strange reason, even though there's a motor in a dirt bike, it's one of the most physically demanding things you can do of all. In fact, there's some physical tests that say it is the most. Amazingly enough, like in that 17 minutes of Supercross, they average like 190 heart rate for 17 minutes, which some doctors say you can't even physically do. And that's what they do literally every weekend. So I could answer the question purely with the physical side and say, oh yeah, Carl Edwards is a gnarly trainer, and Jimmy Johnson's an gnarly trainer, it'd be them. But I will say, what intrigues me is, remember I said before where the best rider will win on the worst bike? Honestly, so much of Supercross and Motocross just comes down to your talent. And you can go to the local level, and you'll know, you could go to a local track around here, Motocross, ask some guy who's gone to all the races, say, who's going to win this next race? And he'll know, because that guy in the gate is just the best rider.
Right.
And you cannot create enough variances of bike or track to make up for that talent.
Right.
So really, the most talented guy, if he trains enough and has his head on straight and isn't hurt, is probably going to win. So I look at, okay, so supposedly Kyle Busch is a phenomenal talent, right? Obviously, he's not as into the physical side, but let's just say he was in Supercross and that's par for the course that they all train. I would assume that someone like that, that has this incredible talent, the cream would rise all the time. He's burned himself with other, you know, losing his cool or losing his temper through the years, and he's gotten better at that now. But I don't think those things would have mattered, because he would have just been faster than everybody and he would have won a lot of races all along.
Right.
Yeah. James Stewart, who's unfortunately kind of on the downside right now, when he was at the peak of his powers, he was just so much more skilled as a motorcycle rider. You could not beat him no matter what kind of hard work you put in. And to me, that seems like kind of what Kyle Busch is. Everyone knew if he gets it together, gets out of his own way, they're all dead.
Right.
And that's kind of where you are sometimes. Well, we were up until Bristol.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yep. Right. Well, that's funny, because obviously if Kyle Busch were to transfer over to the bike world and become a superstar like in NASCAR, I'm sure he would be just as polarizing, and you would have bike fans like as fearful and as worried as they are about the chase coming to Supercross, Motocross. Don't bring Kyle Busch to our series. Oh my God.
I know. And you know what? What's great about the parallel that argument, remember we said, you might not like the chase, but I dare you to not be excited as it's happening.
Yeah.
That's what these hero villain type guys are, right? Like you get them, people either love them or hate them, but they do also complain about the vanilla of everybody else.
Yeah.
And then you're getting not vanilla. It's really...
Kyle Busch is not that, which is why he is so great to cover, in my opinion. He's fun.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I guess part of it, I have to say, I'm like, why would people complain about vanilla, but then complain about Kyle Busch having this somewhat... he could be the bad guy villain mentality. And I was like, never understood that. What I'm starting to wrap my head around is, it's not just, I feel like with Kyle Busch, it's not just that he has personality. It's that they feel like at times maybe he's a sore loser or a bad sportsman, or he gets too angry and he tries to hurt other drivers, spinning someone into the fence in a truck race. So I guess it's that. If you want to be, okay, Dale Earnhardt clearly had a rough, gruff side to him as well. But maybe it never came across as mean-spirited in the same way that Kyle gets sometimes when things don't go his way in the track. I've been trying to wrap my head around, why is he polarizing when every fan says we want more personality?
Right. Well, it's something we'll continue to dissect
probably
ad nauseum until the end of time, probably the next 10 or 15 years. But again, like, I think it's great.
Okay.
I think it adds a lot to the coverage of the sport, even if you're a fan who doesn't like him or a fan who loves him. I think he's fascinating, and certainly NASCAR needs more personalities like that. Supercross needs personalities like that. Maybe Kyle, you know, we've heard Kyle Busch talk about the Indy 500. Maybe in the, I don't think a 45-year-old Kyle Busch is going to climb aboard a motorbike, but who knows? Maybe maybe much like Clint Bowyer, maybe we could see him in a situation like that in the future.
Like I said, I know that even during his recovery last year from the leg injury, he said, he's like, I'm not known as the hardcore trainer guy. But yeah. I'm just saying, if in a parallel universe where he was a motocross racer, so the training was already baked in, par for the course, he's going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
His talent would overcome. It's just funny, though, because I know, okay, so over the weekend I'm listening, and it didn't work out for him in the Xfinity race, and then he's immediately mad that you can't pass on the track, which might be true. You know, and that seems like it rubs some people the wrong way.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, so there you go. He is being outspoken, not being vanilla, but it's getting people very mad. And I'm like, I guess they just take that. This is the hardest thing in racing. Are you giving excuses or are you giving reasons?
Right.
No one has ever been able to solve which is which. Which is an excuse, which is a reason. And the motocross guys deal with it too.
Yeah, yeah, that is hard to delineate.
Yeah.
All right, well, I feel like we've come somewhat full circle, getting all the way from the chase over to Kyle Busch riding a bike sometime in the future. Stay tuned
circles,
for a supercross or motocross event nearby. No, I'm just kidding. Of course, that's not going to happen. But really appreciate the time, man. Enjoyed this conversation very much. And pleasure having you on. We look forward to seeing you more on NBC and NBCSN this year.
I'm just watching a lot of races and listening and reading a lot of stuff just in case they call me off the bench. I'll try to sound like an expert when I'm on, even though I'm really a motocross guy.
I know you'll bring your fastball when summoned like you did today. So thanks again to Jason for being on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Thank you.